Wexler's point, then, is that much of the cross-cultural conflict we see is a product of the relative decrease in plasticity. One could add that totalitarian regimes seem to have an intuitive awareness that it becomes hard for people to change after a certain age, which is why so much effort is made to indoctrinate the young from an early age. For instance, North Korea, the most thoroughgoing totalitarian regime in existence, places children in school from ages 2.5 to 4 years. They spend almost every waking hour being immersed in a cult of adoration for dictator Kim Jong-il and his father, Kim Il-sung. They can see their parents only on weekends. Practically every story read to them is about the leader. 40% of the primary school textbooks are devoted wholly to describing the two Kims. This continues all the way through school. Hatred of the enemy is drilled in with massed practice as well, so that a brain circuit forms linking the perception of the enemy with negative emotions automatically. A typical math quiz asks, three soldiers from the Korean People's Army killed 30 American soldiers. How many American soldiers were killed by each of them if they all killed an equal number of enemy soldiers? Such perceptual emotional networks, once established in an indoctrinated people, do not lead only to mere differences of opinion between them and their adversaries, but to plasticity-based anatomical differences, which are much harder to bridge or overcome with ordinary persuasion. Wexler's emphasis is on the relative tapering off of plasticity as we age, but it must be said that certain practices used by cults or in brainwashing, which obey the laws of neuroplasticity, demonstrate that sometimes individual identities can be changed in adulthood, even against a person's will. Human beings can be broken down and then develop, or at least add on, neurocognitive structures if their daily lives can be totally controlled, and they can be conditioned by reward and severe punishment and subjected to massed practice, where they are forced to repeat or mentally rehearse various ideological statements. In some cases, this process can actually lead them to unlearn their pre-existing mental structures, as Walter Freeman has observed. These unpleasant outcomes would not be possible if the adult brain were not plastic. A vulnerable brain, how the media reorganize it. The Internet is just one of those things that contemporary humans can spend millions of practice events at, that the average human 1,000 years ago had absolutely no exposure to. Our brains are massively remodeled by this exposure, but so too by reading, by television, by video games, by modern electronics, by contemporary music, by contemporary tools, etc. Michael Merzenich, 2005. We have discussed several reasons plasticity was not discovered sooner, such as the lack of a window into the living brain, and the more simplistic version of localizationism. But there is another reason we did not recognize it, one that is particularly relevant to the culturally modified brain. Almost all neuroscientists, as Merlin Donald writes, had a view of the brain as an isolated organ, almost as though it were contained in a box. And they believe that the mind exists and develops entirely in the head, and that its basic structure is a biological given. The behaviorists and many biologists championed this view. Among those who rejected it were developmental psychologists, because they have generally been sensitive to how outside influences might harm brain development. Television watching, one of the signature activities of our culture, correlates with brain problems. A recent study of more than 2,600 toddlers shows that early exposure to television between the ages of 1 and 3 correlates with problems paying attention and controlling impulses later in childhood. For every hour of TV the toddlers watched each day, their chances of developing serious attentional difficulties at age 7 increased by 10%. This study, as psychologist Joel T. Nigg argues, did not perfectly control for other possible factors influencing the correlation between TV watching and later attentional problems. It might be argued that parents of children with more attentional difficulties deal with them by putting them in front of television sets. Still, the study's findings are extremely suggestive, and given the rise in television watching, demand further investigation. 43% of U.S. children 2 years or younger watch television daily, and a quarter have TVs in their bedrooms. About 20 years after the spread of TV, teachers of young children began to notice that their students had become more restless and had increasing difficulty paying attention. The educator Jane Healy documented these changes in her book, Endangered Minds, speculating they were the product of plastic changes in the children's brains. When those children entered college, professors complained of having to dumb down their courses each new year for students who were increasingly interested in sound bites and intimidated by reading of any length. Meanwhile, the problem was buried by grade inflation and accelerated by pushes for computers in every classroom, which aimed to increase the RAM and gigabytes in the class computers rather than the attention spans and memories of the students. The Harvard psychiatrist Edward Hallowell, an expert on attention deficit disorder, ADD, which is genetic, has linked the electronic media to the rise of attention deficit traits, which are not genetic, in much of the population. Ian H. Robertson and Redmond O'Connell have had promising results using brain exercises to treat attention deficit disorder, and if that can be done, we have reason to hope that mere traits can be treated as well. Most people think that the dangers created by the media are a result of content, but Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian who founded media studies in the 1950s and predicted the Internet 20 years before it was invented, was the first to intuit that the media change our brains irrespective of content, and he famously said, "The medium is the message." McLuhan was arguing that each medium reorganizes our mind and brain in its own unique way, and that the consequences of these reorganizations are far more significant than the effects of the content or message. Erica Michael and Marcel Joust of Carnegie Mellon University did a brain scan study to study whether the medium is indeed the message. They showed that different brain areas are involved in hearing speech and reading it, and different comprehension centers in hearing words and reading them. As Joust put it, the brain constructs the message differently for reading and listening. The pragmatic implication is that the medium is part of the message. Listening to an audiobook leaves a different set of memories than reading does. A newscast heard on the radio is processed differently from the same words read in a newspaper. This finding refutes the conventional theory of comprehension, which argues that a single center in the brain understands words and it doesn't really matter how, by what sense or medium, information enters the brain, because it will be processed in the same way and place. Michael and Joust's experiment shows that each medium creates a different sensory and semantic experience, and, we might add, develops different circuits in the brain. Each medium leads to a change in the balance of our individual senses, increasing some at the expense of others. According to McLuhan, pre-literate man lived with a natural balance of hearing, seeing, feeling, smelling, and tasting. The written word moved pre-literate man from a world of sound to a visual world by switching from speech to reading. Type and the printing press hastened that process. Now the electronic media are bringing sound back and, in some ways, restoring the original balance. Each new medium creates a unique form of awareness in which some senses are stepped up and others stepped down. McLuhan said, "The ratio among our senses is altered. We know from Pascual Leon's work with blindfolded people, stepping down sight, how quickly sensory reorganizations can take place." To say that a cultural medium, such as television, radio, or the Internet, alters the balance of senses does not prove it is harmful. Much of the harm from television and other electronic media, such as music videos and computer games, comes from their effect on attention. Children and teenagers who sit in front of fighting games are engaged in massed practice and are incrementally rewarded. Video games, like internet porn, meet all the conditions for plastic brain map changes. A team at the Hammersmith Hospital in London designed a typical video game in which a tank commander shoots the enemy and dodges enemy fire. The experiment showed that dopamine, the reward neurotransmitter, also triggered by addictive drugs, is released in the brain during these games. People who are addicted to computer games show all the signs of other addictions, cravings when they stop, neglect of other activities, euphoria when on the computer, and a tendency to deny or minimize their actual involvement. Television, music videos, and video games, all of which use television techniques, unfold at a much faster pace than real life, and they are getting faster, which causes people to develop an increased appetite for high-speed transitions in those media. It is the form of the television medium, cuts, edits, zooms, pans, and sudden noises, that alters the brain by activating what Pavlov called the orienting response, which occurs whenever we sense a sudden change in the world around us, especially a sudden movement. We instinctively interrupt whatever we are doing to turn, pay attention, and get our bearings. The orientation response evolved, no doubt, because our forebears were both predators and prey and needed to react to situations that could be dangerous or could provide sudden opportunities for such things as food or sex or simply to novel situations. The response is physiological. The heart rate decreases for 4 to 6 seconds. Television triggers this response at a far more rapid rate than we experience it in life, which is why we can't keep our eyes off the TV screen, even in the middle of an intimate conversation, and why people watch TV a lot longer than they intend. Because typical music videos, action sequences, and commercials trigger orienting responses at a rate of 1 per second. Watching them puts us into continuous orienting response with no recovery. No wonder people report feeling drained from watching TV. Yet we acquire a taste for it and find slower changes boring. The cost is that such activities as reading, complex conversation, and listening to lectures become more difficult. McLuhan's insight was that the communications media both extend our range and implode into us. His first law of media is that all the media are extensions of aspects of man. Writing extends memory. When we use a paper and pen to record our thoughts, the car extends the foot, clothing the skin. Electronic media are extensions of our nervous systems. The telegraph, radio, and telephone extend the range of the human ear. The television camera extends the eye and sight. The computer extends the processing capacities of our central nervous system. He argued that the process of extending our nervous system also alters it. The implosion of the media into us, affecting our brains, is less obvious, but we have seen many examples already. When Mrzenek and colleagues devised the cochlear implant, a medium that translates sound waves into electrical impulses, the brain of an implant patient rewired itself to read those impulses. Fast Forward is a medium that, like radio or an interactive computer game, conveys language, sounds, and images, and radically rewires the brain in the process. When Bacharita attached blind people to a camera and they were able to perceive shapes, faces, and perspective, he demonstrated that the nervous system can become part of a larger electronic system. All electronic devices rewire the brain. People who write on a computer are often at a loss when they have to write by hand or dictate because their brains are not wired to translate thoughts into cursive writing or speech at high speed. When computers crash and people have mini nervous breakdowns, there is more than a little truth in their cry, "I feel like I've lost my mind." As we use an electronic medium, our nervous system extends outward, and the medium extends inward. Electronic media are so effective at altering the nervous system because they both work in similar ways and are basically compatible and thus easily linked. Both involve the instantaneous transmission of electric signals to make linkages. Because our nervous system is plastic, it can take advantage of this compatibility and merge with the electronic media, making a single, larger system. Indeed, it is the nature of such systems to merge, whether they are biological or man-made. The nervous system is an internal medium, communicating messages from one area of the body to another, and it evolved to do for multicelled organisms such as ourselves what the electronic media do for humanity, connect disparate parts. McLuhan expressed this electronic extension of the nervous system and the self in comic terms. Now man is beginning to wear his brain outside his skull and his nerves outside his skin. In a famous formulation, he said, "Today, after more than a century of electric technology, we have extended our central nervous system itself in a global embrace, abolishing both space and time as far as our planet is concerned." Space and time are abolished because electronic media link faraway places instantaneously, giving rise to what he called the global village. This extension is possible because our plastic nervous system can integrate itself with an electronic system. Appendix 2. Plasticity and the Idea of Progress. The idea of the brain as plastic has appeared in previous times, in flashes, then disappeared. But even though it is only now being established as a fact of mainstream science, these earlier appearances left their traces and made possible a receptivity to the idea in spite of the enormous opposition each of the neuroplasticians faced from fellow scientists. As early as 1762, the Swiss philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712-1778, who faulted the mechanistic view of nature of his time, argued that nature was alive and had a history and was changing over time. "Our nervous systems are not like machines," he said, "but are alive and able to change." In his book, Emile, or On Education, the first detailed book on child development ever written, he proposed that the organization of the brain was affected by our experience, and that we need to exercise our senses and mental abilities the way we exercise our muscles. Rousseau maintained that even our emotions and passions are, to a great extent, learned early in childhood. He imagined radically transforming human education and culture based on the premise that many aspects of our nature that we think are fixed are, in fact, changeable, and that this malleability is a defining human trait. He wrote, "To understand a man, look to men, and to understand men, look to the animals." When he compared us with other species, he saw what he called human perfectibility and brought the French word perfectibilité into vogue, using it to describe a specifically human plasticity or malleability, which distinguishes us in degree from animals. "Several months after an animal's birth," he observed, "it is for the most part what it will be for the rest of its life. But human beings change throughout life because of their perfectibility." It was our perfectibility, he argued, that allowed us to develop different kinds of mental faculties and to change the balance among our existing mental faculties and senses. But this could also be problematic because it disrupted the natural balance of our senses. Because our brains were so sensitive to experience, they were also more vulnerable to being shaped by it. Educational schools such as the Montessori School, with its emphasis on the education of the senses, grew out of Rousseau's observations. He was also the precursor to McLuhan, who would argue centuries later that certain technologies and media alter the ratio or balance of the senses. When we say that the instantaneous electronic media, television sound bites, and a shift away from literacy have created overly intense wired people with short attention spans, we are speaking Rousseau's language about a new kind of environmental problem that interferes with our cognition. Rousseau was also concerned that the balance between our senses and our imagination can be disturbed by the wrong kinds of experience. In 1783, Rousseau's contemporary Charles Bonnet, 1720-1793, also a Swiss philosopher and a naturalist familiar with Rousseau's writings, wrote to an Italian scientist, Michel Vincenzo Malacarne, 1744-1816, proposing that neural tissue might respond to exercise as do muscles. Malacarne set out to test Bonnet's hypothesis experimentally. He took pairs of birds that came from the same clutch of eggs and raised half of them under enriched circumstances, stimulated by intensive training for several years. The other half received no training. He did the same experiment with two littermate dogs. When Malacarne sacrificed the animals and compared their brain size, he found that the animals that received training had larger brains, particularly in a part of the brain called the cerebellum, demonstrating the influence of enriched circumstances and training on the development of an individual's brain. Malacarne's work was all but forgotten until revived and mastered by Rosenzweig and others in the 20th century. Perfectibilité, the mixed blessing. Though Rousseau, who died in 1778, could not have known Malacarne's results, he showed an uncanny ability to anticipate what perfectibilité meant for humanity. It provided hope, but was not always a blessing. Because we could change, we did not always know what was natural in us and what was acquired from our culture. Because we could change, we could be overly shaped by culture and society to a point where we drifted too far from our true nature and became alienated from ourselves. While we may rejoice at the thought that the brain and human nature may be improved, the idea of human perfectibility or plasticity stirs up a hornet's nest of moral problems. Earlier thinkers, going back to Aristotle, who did not speak of a plastic brain, argued that there was an obvious ideal or perfect mental development. Our mental and emotional faculties were provided by nature, and a healthy mental development was achieved by using those faculties and perfecting them. Rousseau understood that if human mental and emotional life and the brain are malleable, we can no longer be so certain what a normal or perfect mental development would look like. There could be many different kinds of development. Perfectibility meant that we could no longer be so certain about what it meant to perfect ourselves. Realizing this moral problem, Rousseau used the term perfectibility in an ironic sense. From perfectibility to the idea of progress. Any change in how we understand the brain ultimately affects how we understand human nature. After Rousseau, the idea of perfectibility quickly got tied to the idea of progress. Condorcet, 1743 to 1794, the French philosopher and mathematician who was a major participant in the French Revolution, argued that human history was the story of progress and linked it to our perfectibility. He wrote, "Nature has set no term to the perfection of human faculties. The perfectibility of man is truly indefinite, and the progress of this perfectibility has no other limit than the duration of the globe upon which nature has cast us." Human nature was continually improvable in intellectual and moral terms, and humans should not give themselves fixed limits to their possible perfection. This view was somewhat less ambitious than seeking ultimate perfection, but still naively utopian. The twin ideas of progress and perfectibility came to America through the thought of Thomas Jefferson, who appears to have been introduced to Condorcet by Benjamin Franklin. Among the American founders, Jefferson was most open to the idea and wrote, "I am among those who think well of the human character generally. I believe also, with Condorcet, that his mind is perfectible to a degree of which we cannot as yet form any conception." Not all the founders agreed with Jefferson, but Alexis de Tocqueville, visiting America from France in 1830, remarked that Americans, in contrast to others, seemed to believe in the indefinite perfectibility of man. It is the idea of scientific and political progress, and its constant ally, the idea of individual perfectibility, that may well make Americans so interested in self-improvement, self-transformation, and self-help books, as well as in solving problems and in having a can-do attitude. As hopeful as this all sounds, the idea of human perfectibility in theory has also had a dark side in practice. When utopian revolutionaries in France and Russia, smitten with the idea of progress and embracing a naive belief in the plasticity of human beings, looked around them and saw an imperfect society, they tended to blame individuals for standing in the way of progress. A reign of terror and the gulag followed. We must be careful clinically, too, as we speak of brain plasticity, not to fall into blaming those who, despite this new science, cannot benefit or change. Clearly, neuroplasticity teaches that the brain is more malleable than some have thought, but to move from calling it malleable to calling it perfectible raises expectations to a dangerous level. The plastic paradox teaches that neuroplasticity can also be responsible for many rigid behaviors and even some pathologies, along with all the potential flexibility that is within us. As the idea of plasticity becomes the focus of human attention in our time, we would be wise to remember that it is a phenomenon that produces effects we think of as both bad and good. Rigidity and flexibility, vulnerability, and an unexpected resourcefulness. The economist and scholar Thomas Sowell has observed, while the use of the word perfectibility has faded away over the centuries, the concept has survived, largely intact, to the present time. The notion that the human being is highly plastic material is still central among many contemporary thinkers. Sowell's detailed study, A Conflict of Vision, shows that many major Western political philosophers can be classified and better understood by taking into account the extent to which they reject or accept this human plasticity and have a more or less constrained view of human nature. While it has often been the case that more conservative or right-leaning thinkers such as Adam Smith or Edmund Burke seem to champion the constrained view of human nature, while liberal or left-leaning thinkers such as Condorcet or William Godwin have tended to believe that it is less constrained, there are times or issues about which conservatives appear to have the more plastic view and liberals the more constrained view. For instance, in recent times, a number of conservative commentators have argued that sexual orientation is a matter of choice and have spoken as though it might be changed by effort or experience. That is, that it is a plastic phenomenon, whereas, by and large, liberal commentators have tended to argue that it is hardwired and all in the genes. But not all thinkers offer a strictly constrained or unconstrained vision of human nature, and there are those who have had a mixed view of human changeability, perfectibility, and progress. What we have learned by looking closely at neuroplasticity and the plastic paradox is that human neuroplasticity contributes to both the constrained and the unconstrained aspects of our nature. Thus, while it is true that the history of Western political thought turns in large part upon the attitudes that various ages and thinkers have held toward the question of human plasticity broadly understood, the elucidation of human neuroplasticity in our time, if carefully thought through, shows that plasticity is far too subtle a phenomenon to unambiguously support a more constrained or unconstrained view of human nature, because in fact, it contributes to both human rigidity and flexibility, depending upon how it is cultivated. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Brain That Changes Itself, Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science, by Norman Doidge, M.D. Copyright 2007 by Norman Doidge, M.D. Read by Jim Bond. Directed by Laurel Kelly Young. Engineered by Corey Young. Performance copyright 2008, Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliantaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.